We will now hear from Peter Lumelo, who will talk about Canadian culture and society. Peter was born in England and lives in New York, which obviously makes him an expert on Canada. But he did spend some time in Canada and found a Canadian girl whom he married, and who is here with us today, was to fortify his morale and his morals. And he, I think, learned a great deal from her, so he will be able to speak about Canada with expertise. Peter has written, to my knowledge, two books. One, The Wall Street Gurus, which made a topic to me totally uninteresting, fascinating when I read it. And he has a new book coming out called The Patriotic Game, which is about Canada and being published, I think, in a few weeks by Kay Porter. Peter Bumelo.
Thanks, Ernest. Ladies and gentlemen, let me just talk about culture and family. I'm going to talk about culture in a larger family, the Canadian state. My publishers insist on calling my book, which is a study of Canadian political culture, The Patriot Game, partly because it's an attack on Canadian nationalism with a capital C and a capital N. That's a local variant, really, of socialism, but it happens to have taken nationalist protective coloration. I wanted to subtitle the book, Canada and the Canadian Question Revisited, which, in homage, really, to Goldwyn Smith, the great Victorian liberal who wrote a classical liberal analysis of Canada in the 1890s. But my publishers, who are Canadians, of course, adamantly refused to allow me to do this on the grounds that no book with Canada in the title was going to sell. This tells you quite a lot, actually, about the Canadian psyche, the Canadian mentality. At this point, I think I'll do what the Canadian government does and take a Canadian content poll. How many of the audience are actually Canadians here? Uh-huh, thanks. And I guess some of them, like myself and Professor Pangle, are sort of half-breeds, spending quite a lot of time here. Because of Professor Pangle's interesting talk, I won't go into any of the factual basis of it behind in the Canadian situation, which obviously most of you know. But I would like to say that there's a central demographic fact about the Canadian state, which is that of the 25 or 6 million people, 6 million of them are French and living in Quebec. They're entirely concentrated in one province, practically no francophones outside of Quebec. And this is a central fact of Canadian political life. Well, as I say, there's a sort of malaise about Canada. In the early 1900s, it was fashionable to say that the 20th century would belong to Canada. Even as late as the 1960s, Pierre Trudeau said it was going to be a brilliant prototype for the moulding of tomorrow's civilization. You don't hear this so much anymore, partly because it's become obvious that the 20th century actually belongs to the Federal Liberal Party, which has been in power more or less continuously since 1896, with a few exceptions. There are various ways of looking at Canada's problems, but I think one important one is to reflect upon the fact that semi-official statistics over a period of 30-odd years, going back to the Gordon Report and as recently as Simon Reisman in an article last year, have made the point that the Canadian living standard is generally about 70% of that of the US, a remarkably low figure, particularly if you're in this city. But of course it is an average figure and it takes into account the presence of very large rural welfare slums in Newfoundland, where my wife comes from, and so on. Now, Canadians sort of accept this this systematic lagging that can be American living standards, a sort of a law of life, is in their melancholy way. They don't complain about it. But actually, there is absolutely no reason why it should happen. Canadian resource base is at least as good, much better, in fact, on a per capita basis than the Americans. The population is conveniently concentrated in large cities. The urbanization is significantly larger than it is in the US. The climate, which they always moan about, isn't all that much worse than the northern tier of US states. Beyond that, the Canadians, as Professor Pangle pointed out last night, spend practically nothing on defense, which in the US is consuming 6-7% of the GNP. And also, the Canadians don't have an underclass problem, which, as anybody who's lived in an American city knows, imposes immense costs on American society, and of course is a major item in their budget. Canada should actually have a higher living standard than the US, it seems to me. It should be Switzerland, which is also rather a cold place. But in fact, it's more like England. In fact, if you look at the fundamental statistics of GNP, deficit GNP, that kind of thing, it actually looks more like Italy. Well, this is a very sad situation. And it's even more sad that Canadians accept this with such apparent passivity. I diagnose what a politician we don't mention anymore, Pat Moynihan, once described as a tangle of pathologies behind the situation. I spent about 150,000 words explaining this tangle of pathologies in my book, but I'm going to do it here in about a quarter of an hour. I think a useful way of looking at Canadian politics is to appropriate a concept developed by the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, the concept of the dominant ideology. Gramsci argued that at any given point in society, the ruling class has imposed its own ideology so successfully, frequently, that its values are actually accepted by other elements in society, the lower classes and so on. And therefore, this holds the society together long after the material basis for the power of the ruling class has vanished. He had a lot of opportunity to contemplate this because he was trying to convert Italy to communism before Vatican II. So he was obviously very conscious of that. He said that the task of the revolutionary when he's not on the barricades actually shooting people, which he described as the revolution, the active revolution, the revolutionary movement, is to engage in a passive revolution, to go around subverting ideas, and that this could take many years before you could get a society into a situation where you could actually move to the active stage. Well, in the Canadian case, there have been two quite clear and distinct dominant ideologies. The first one, which prevailed from the middle of the 19th century, and in fact was visible in a rather diluted way and well within living memory, was sort of a greater British ideology, the ideology of British imperialism. You see, when the British settled these areas, they did so in the Greek sense. They sent people out from the homeland and planted them in odd places all around the world. And they were expected to remain part of a British nation, what J.B. Morton, the Canadian historian, has referred to as a local brew of Britishness. And they were extremely successful at doing that in this country. The Canadians flew the Union Jack until very recently. When Britain was at war, Canada was at war, the Canadians fought in South Africa and in the Sudan, as well as in both First World Wars. This is one reason why I'm rather bothered when people try to derive Canadian characteristics from what happened in Charlottetown at the time of Confederation. The people who founding fathers of Confederation were not engaged in a theoretical exercise. They weren't contemplating what sort of society they could develop as an ideal. They were just engaged in consolidating the local British faction. They wanted to put it together on a firm basis because they were afraid of the Americans, because they wanted to remain part of the British nation. I emphasize this because it's almost completely forgotten now in Canada. But I think that a lot of the malaise of the Canadian Conservatives can be attributed to the fact that they're suffering post-imperial trauma. Their values, and they identify with Britain, they identify with the Empire, their values were British. And then quite abruptly in the late 60s or even earlier, they found that this was no longer an option to them, and they simply haven't evolved an alternative yet. Well, the second dominant ideology, which is now in control of Canada, but was evolving throughout the 20th century, is the liberal ideology. In many respects, the liberal ideology is very similar to the sort of social welfareism practiced by the American Democrats. But it does have some local differences. As I say, it only really became dominant really after Pierre Trudeau became Prime Minister. Diefenbaker, for example, was clearly a proponent of the Greater British ideology and objected bitterly when he found the British were going into the common market. But still, the Liberal ideology was very powerful in Canada throughout the period of the Liberals' electoral hegemony. For example, as early as 1939, the bureaucrats in external affairs, all of whom were Liberals, of course, because they've been appointed by the Liberals, were bitterly distressed to realise that they weren't going to be able to prevent the Canadians from joining in the Second World War. There's quite an extensive documentation of this. One of them wrote, the sympathies of too many of our people are too deeply engaged. So they weren't able to prevent that, but they were able to generally behave like a dog in a manger over the question of imperial cooperation. And gradually they did take control in Canada. The supreme test of a dominant ideology is whether it can convince its opponent that it's right. To a large extent, the British were able to do that. If you look at Quebec history in the 19th century, you'll see that the French had immense respect for British institutions, and a whole string of French-Canadian prime ministers in Canada used to say things like, I'm an Englishman who speaks French. It's a very common saying. There's at least three or four prominent Victorian Francophones who are supposed to have said that. Well, in this case, of course, in the liberal ideology's case, they triumphantly succeeded in convincing the Tories of their rectitude. And the example we can see of that is the fact that the Canadian Conservatives have dedicated themselves to this Quebec strategy, the attempt to win an election in Quebec. There is, of course, a perfectly rational alternative electoral strategy for the Francophones, for the Tories, and that is to win an election in English Canada, because they could easily take control of the government just with English seats, with Anglophone seats. But the Tories have become convinced that this is immoral, that it's immoral to act to represent English Canada in the way that, for example, the PQ unhesitatingly represents French Canada, or tries to. In the last election, of course, both strategies actually won. The Tories won in English Canada. They could have formed a government without Quebec. And they also won in Quebec for reasons which I think are peculiar to the internal politics of Quebec rather than anything else. But still, this accepting this liberal ideology was crucial to the career of Brian Mulroney. Without him, without that, Mulroney would not be the leader of the Tory party, because he in many ways quite unrepresentative. Anyway, I'm going to discuss this liberal ideology now. I'm going to discuss it in the negative, because I basically disagree with all of it. the first point I want to make is, I think, it's like Metternich said about Italy, Canada is merely a geographical expression. For historical reasons, it's acquired the legal form of a nation-state, but it's not a nation. Culturally and geographically, the Anglophone communities are growing more separate every year. People don't realise this very often because they don't look at the census in very great detail, and Canadian reporting is so wrong. But in fact, if you look at the numbers, you'll see that the numbers of Francophones living in out of Quebec and the number of Anglophones living in Quebec is falling not merely in relative but in absolute terms.
the two communities are just polarizing, they're separating, they're voting against Trudeau's version of Canada, bilingual, bicultural Canada. They're voting against it with their U-Haul trucks. Incidentally, I'd also argue that the English Canada itself has very significant divisions, notably the West, but also I think the Maritimes and particularly Newfoundland. And all of these divisions constitute fault lines underlying the Canadian polity. Another point on which I disagree with the liberal ideology is that I think that it's perfectly clear that within the framework of Confederation, Quebec is emerging as a genuine nation-state. History doesn't move in straight lines. There's a cyclical rhythm to Francophone nationalism, as well as a rising long-run secular trend, as we say, in the stock market. In recent years, Canadian attention has quite naturally focused on the decline of organized separatism. But this overlooks the fact that the events of the Quiet Revolution have left the Francophones... French opinion as their political expression. In other words, in Ottawa jargon, the de nation concept, the idea that Canada should resolve its internal problems by making Quebec a French-speaking enclave within an English-speaking state, has actually triumphed posthumously over the alternative, which I'm not going to attempt to pronounce, that Canada should be a bicultural and binational state from coast to coast, which of course is what Pierre Trudeau wanted. Gorwin Smith once said that there was a lot of what he called poetic talk about this relationship between English and French Canada, but that in fact this was all an illusion. And I essentially agree with that. I think that the fact of having these two nations in the same state has been an unmitigated curse for both of them, particularly for English Canada and above all for English Anglophone conservatives. I mean, it's a very salutary thought that if it hadn't been for Quebec, and its support of the Liberal Party, English Canada would have voted for in a majority for the Conservative Party in every election since 1953, with the exception of 1968. That's more actually than the Republicans have won the presidential elections since that period in the U.S. I offer that because it's frequently said, and many Americans believe that Canada is a more liberal society than America. It's just not true. As a matter of fact, it seems to me to be perfectly clear, as a complete outsider, that English Canada is essentially part of a greater English-speaking North American nation. It's a sectional variation within America, in the same way that, for example, the American South is a sectional variation, quite distinct, but also sharing common characteristics. The South, incidentally, going back to what Tom Pangle said last night, I think you could there find the organic conservatism, which he was saying he thought was a characteristic of Canadian conservatism. The section I would most compare Canada to, of course, is the Upper Midwest, or possibly the Pacific Northwest. And in both of those areas of the U.S., you'll find the same kinds of interest in social democracy, in state ownership of this and that you find in Canada. In other words, there is not a distinct English Canadian culture as the liberals wish to maintain. And one aspect of that which is worth considering is multiculturalism. Well, one of the tenets of the liberal ideology is that Canada has not been attempting to assimilate its immigrants in the way that Americans have done, into a melting pot, but instead that there's going to be a Canadian mosaic and that these people are encouraged to maintain their own cultures. This is all nonsense, of course. I mean, it didn't exist, this idea, before about 1955. But the interesting thing is that if you look at the American situation, you find exactly the same phenomenon developed in America in the 1960s. The federal government, for example, now is supporting some 60 or 70 programs to teach immigrant children, to educate them in their own language. They've completely abandoned the idea that all Americans should be educated in English. Very foolishly of them, but they've done it. And at exactly the same time that the Canadian liberals were uniquely being Canadian and inventing the Canadian mosaic.
One of the real problems that Canada has now, in many ways it's a central problem, is that its political system is just very badly designed. It seriously misrepresents Canadian reality. They basically imported the parliamentary system, which isn't any good in England actually right now. It's in a high degenerate state. But it was completely unsuited for the continental-sized polity that Canada became since Confederation. There are a number of characteristics which, according to the liberal ideology, are typical of Canadian political culture, which are actually the result of institutions, part of the parliamentary institution. I won't go into these in great detail, but I would urge you to reflect on the fact that if the Americans were electing a leader on the same basis as the Canadians do, Tip O'Neill would now be Prime Minister. He would have won re-election in 1984. Because he controls the House of Representatives. He leads the majority party there, which is elected on the same basis as the only legislative assembly in Canada, the House of Commons. Another problem in the Canadian system, of course, is its absolute lack of geographic balance. It's a head-counting system. That's what enables central Canada to dominate Confederation. The Senate, which in America, for example, would have prevented anything like the NEP. The Senate is moribund here. Now, this political system has allowed the emergence of an extremely strong, unusually large and powerful political class in Canada, a new class. But actually, not simply in the sense of educators and journalists and other hangers-on, in the sense of the civil service. The civil service in Ottawa is significantly larger on a proportional basis. There are more civil servants living in Ottawa than there are American civil servants living in Washington. And this group, the civil service, continuously goes around inventing policies which essentially benefit itself and its clients. The National Energy Program was one, which was really an attempt to expropriate the West and divert the surplus value to English Canada, to Central Canada, but the Canadian nationalism, which is a rent-seeking activity on the behalf of the elite, that just is basically attempt to extract rent from the entire economy and keep them in the hands of Toronto journalists and things like that. That's another. But the supreme example is bilingualism. I'm going to spend a few moments on bilingualism because I think it's central to the way Canada works right now. The Canadian state has undertaken to deliver federal services in either French or English, right across from St. John's to Victoria, and is putting immense pressure on the provincial governments to do the same thing. Well, there are bilingual states in the world, but there are none of them with the same demographic base that Canada has. There are only 15% of Canadians who are actually bilingual. In other words, there are only 15% who are eligible for the major civil service posts, or now, as we realise, since Mulroney's been elected, to be leader of a party. Apparently, you can't be leader of a party, you can't be prime minister unless you're bilingual. Now, the geographic, the distribution of these bilinguals is even more alarming. Almost all of them live in Quebec, or in the immediate border areas. And almost all of them, about two-thirds of them, are actually francophones. That means that you're looking at maybe one in 14 or 15 Anglophones who can speak French, who are bilingual sufficiently to be elected Prime Minister. This is a highly unnatural situation. You see, the effect of bilingualism, it's a massively regressive piece of social engineering. It concentrates power in the hands of groups from which it's been slipping. The Francophones in Quebec, because their numbers are falling relative to the size of the population. The Montreal Anglos, because they've lost power to Toronto and the West. The upper middle class in general, because they're the only people who generally speaking, going to educate their children to take trouble to speak French. So it's really a deviation from the North American social norms. And it's an important thing for civil service. The civil service is the only part of Canada which is remotely approaches the bicultural and bilingual ideal. See, the civil service in Ottawa is like the Prussian army. It is the state. It's the repository of national values. And that's why they unhesitatingly impose policies like the National Energy Program. The National Energy Program was developed by Department of Mines and Resources actually while the Tories were in power in 1979. The Tories wanted to do something different, but the civil servants didn't agree with them, so they went ahead and organized their own plan. And when the Liberals came back to power, there it was really waiting for them. It's an extraordinary extent of the power of the permanent government. Well, time's getting on, so I'll just cut this short now, and I'll go on to what I think might actually happen. Generally speaking, most people think nothing ever happens in Canada. Canadian politics are just incredibly stable. When I was at the Financial Post some years ago, the associate editor of the Financial Post, Dalton Robertson, who is a Canadian, said to myself and the editor, who's an Australian, that the only people interested in Canadian politics, he said, are immigrants, you and Neville Nankervell, who's an Australian. When I want to know about Canadian politics, I ask my friends. His friend was Keith Davis, so it was easier for him to do that. I don't agree with this. I think our Canadian politics are quite volatile. You see, for one thing, the Liberals only really imposed this the bilingual thing and so on after 1960. The full impact of it hasn't yet been felt yet. There's no reason, of course, why the Canadian Confederation couldn't go blundering on in its underachieving way for a long time. As Adam Smith said, there's a lot of ruin in a nation. But I think it might not. It could be brought to a sudden stop, for example, by some kind of financial economic catastrophe. Canada has a particularly acute form of the general crisis of the welfare state that we see everywhere in the late 20th century. For nearly 100 years now, politicians have been taxing and taxing and spending and spending and electing, as Harry Hopkins put it. The problem is now they've got up to the upper limit of the economy's, of the taxing capacity of the economy. Every time they raise taxes, it provokes incredible tax revolts. Well, the Canadians are in a very bad situation here. They can't bring their fiscal situation into balance because they spend so much of the money on bribing various key groups in the Canadian system. The political economy of Canada basically works by concentrating the rents of the economy in the hands of Central Canada, which then proceeds to bribe various key people on the periphery to keep them quiet, you see. It's very hard to withdraw these bribes, much harder than it is in the US, and that's been hard enough, God knows. Another point that I think is going to be a problem for Canada is the continued emergence of Quebec as a nation. As I say, at the moment things are fairly quiet in Quebec, but they've been quiet at various periods before in the last 200 years. And then they flare up again. We don't know when they will flare up again and what will trigger it, but it will flare up at some point. Trudeau, when he wanted to prevent Quebec Francophone enclave in Quebec, the De Nation strategy, knew what he was doing. He knew that if they got control of their own institution, then the momentum of nationalism would be very hard to resist. Once they had control, they could actually steer Quebec out. And there's a particular reason to do with the nature of the parliamentary system, why this is possible. The parliamentary system exaggerates the stability of the country. It's a very rigid system. But once you've gone past a certain point, it starts to work the opposite way. If there were a large faction of Francophones in Quebec, in the parliament, in Ottawa, they could do what the Irish nationalists did and just basically paralyze the government. And that's what happened in the 19th century, and the result of that was that in 1914 there was a Home Rule Bill on the statute books in Westminster when the First World War broke out. Sir John Macdonald actually was very alarmed that the Nova Scotia separatists would do this directly after Confederation, but they proved to be gentlemen and didn't disrupt Parliament, and consequently everybody's forgotten about them. For some reason, the separatists in Quebec have been extremely reluctant to run in federal elections. This appears to be sort of like a Gallic excess of logic. They think that if they're separatists, they shouldn't participate in federal institutions. All I can say is this didn't seem to bother the Irish very much. I think another issue that is going to be a problem for the Liberal ideology is the recovery of English Canada from its post-imperial hangover. Sooner or later, they're going to come into conflict. They're going to lose their current pervasive sense of guilt and start to ask themselves questions about the Canadian political economy. Why does it have to be organized around Quebec? Why is Canada now basically the Greater Quebec, with Quebec concerns paramount from coast to coast? That's sort of a cultural issue. I think eventually English Canada will recover from this hangover. The issue in Canadian politics then would be not whether Quebec could secede, but whether it should be expelled. I also think that there are sectional problems in English Canada, which may cause some trouble. It amazes me, for example, that the Western provinces are still in Confederation, and we do see, of course, various separatist noises there. I think that there's been three flurries of separatism in the last 5 or 10 years. It's at a fairly low level, but so was Quebec separatism as late as the 1960s. I think also that we may see a time of troubles in Canadian politics, and here I agree with what David Somerville said last night, I think that Mulroney, who is essentially attempting to hijack the Liberal state and rule Canada in the same way that Trudeau would have done, I think it's not going to be difficult, easy for him to do, because he isn't Trudeau. He's not as good he hasn't got the same roots in Quebec that Trudeau did. At the same time, he doesn't have the same factional support in English Canada that Trudeau got from his association with the NDP and the Canadian left generally. In other words, I don't think that Mulroney is going to succeed in creating a Tory electoral coalition to match the Liberal electoral coalition that's been dominant up to now. On the other hand, I don't see the Liberals easily recreating theirs, because certainly not under an English-speaking leader. So I think we may see a period of fluidity in Canadian politics somewhat similar to the early 60s, when there was a series of minority governments. Well, I think that's about all I have to say right now. I'll cut this short. I'll conclude by telling a story. In 1975, in the winter of 75, a man came to see me at the Financial Post. He was one of the minor contenders for the Tory leadership. I'd had an interview with him before, but he cancelled it because he thought I wanted to talk about economics. People think when you're a financial journalist you want to talk about economics all the time. So he said he was going to talk to his advisors. Certainly he showed up in December of 75. And I began rather reluctantly by asking him about the Economic Council's report on Canada, Looking Outward, which had actually advocated continental free trade and had therefore been immediately attacked as calling for the annexation of Canada. I said to this chap, "What do you think about this?" He immediately fell apart. He said, "Frankly, I just don't know." He's only talking here about the central issue of Canadian economic policy. You know, it's the only issue that's really mattered in Canadian economic policy for the last 100 years. He said, "I don't know. You see, when I came into politics, I had to choose between learning French and learning economics. And I chose to learn French." So I was completely disarmed by this. I thought, what a nice, honest, and obviously man who's obviously destined to remain a minor candidate. And I went off to the Middle East, actually. I didn't come back until after the Tory Confederation, which this man had won because he was Joe Clark. And for the benefit of the Americans, Clark was the Prime Minister in Canada at 79, and he's now the Foreign Minister. And I learned to my horror that there's an excellent chance he may replace Mulroney. There's several morals to be drawn from this story, but I leave them to you. Thanks very much.